From the Vault, a true crime podcast, is a production of JPF Productions and Bebo Studios. All opinions stated are those of the podcast and its hosts and are not to be considered factual. Any facts related to today's case has been backed up by resources provided in the description for the podcast. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of From the Vault right here on Anchor and wherever you can find your favorite podcast. I'm Jason Futch, and thank you all for joining me again as I discuss the Henry County John Doe, a young man who had been found in Knightstown, Indiana in October of 2003. On this episode of From the Vault, it is going to be a special re-release, kind of. Nick is not with me this week, but he will be rejoining me on the next episode as he and I talk about Larry Eiler, the highway killer, and his unidentified victims. And I do want to clarify about that episode. It's not going to be a profile on Larry Eiler. At From the Vault, we refuse to profile serial killers for the simple fact that those who profile these killers tend to glorify them. And we're not in the business of glorifying serial killers. So, with that being said, you will never find an episode of From the Vault talking specifically about a serial killer, but we will talk about their victims. And in that particular episode, we are going to be talking about Larry Eiler's unidentified victims. And though contrary to popular belief that he only has one unidentified victim, he actually has more. And I'm going to cover that with Nick on the next episode. So stay tuned to that. And then after that, we'll be going into our season finale. So we'll keep you posted on what's going on and we'll go from there. In the meantime, we are going to stay in Indiana for a little bit and we're going to talk about the Henry County John Doe. This was a John Doe that was found on October 2nd of 2003 behind an abandoned gas station in Knightstown, Indiana. Now, I originally covered this case on an episode of True Cold Case Files from November 8th, 2019. And I recorded it with Daisy Chains, who was a co-host on my show. She was the regular co-host before Nick. I remember having a discussion with Daisy talking about this case, and she had told me that this is perhaps one of the more peculiar cases that her and I had ever covered. In fact, this was a very peculiar case to her as well, personally, because she had been assisting in trying to identify John and Jane Does from across the country for years, and this one always stood out to her as being one of the most intriguing ones because of the situation here. Now, a little backstory about that episode. I originally reached out to the investigators at the Henry County Sheriff's Office in April of 2018 for the story. Keep in mind, that is a year before the very first episode of True Cold Case Files came out. Now, with that being said, because I was starting out, I was, you know, kind of, if you will, green in the industry of podcasting a true crime podcast, I didn't necessarily understand how FOIA requests worked. I didn't understand, you know, the full research that was involved in a case like this before, you know, going live on something like this. So, yeah, there was a couple of setbacks. And if you hear the original quality of this episode, you'll understand what I mean. In fact, I will be playing the first minute of the original recording to give you guys an idea of what we're talking about here. Now, with that being said, my FOIA request was rejected by Detective Captain Edward Manning of the Henry County Sheriff's Office on the grounds that most of the information that had been released was already available on the internet. Though I respected the captain's decision, I disagreed with it, and I'll tell you why. There were several voids that I still felt that needed to be filled in this case, including the alleged sighting of this John Doe on September 30th of 2003. I had a lot of questions about that, and I was hoping that my FOIA request could answer some of those questions. And some of these questions that I asked myself were, was the FBI involved at any point because of the Doe's connection to Ohio? Because you got to keep in mind, If he lived in Ohio and was murdered in Ohio and then transported to Indiana and dumped, this becomes a federal case. Keep that in mind, folks. How did they know about his visit to the Walmart in Reynoldsburg? There were no details at the time stating how he was sighted there. There was no information regarding who saw him there or why he was there. My other question was, are there photographic stills available of this John Doe at the Walmart or in this supposed red car that he was seen driving? And what did he purchase at Walmart? So these were questions that I had asked myself because I feel like they're important questions. And again, I was hoping that the FOIA request would answer all these questions. And just to clarify, FOIA means Freedom of Information Act request. And this is a typical request that podcasters like myself will make if we're going to be digging into a case. So that way we make sure that we have all of our facts straight. We're not lying to you. We're not creating a story for you that will come out false later on down the road. We want to make sure that our shit is straight. And that is why we make these requests. Captain Manning appeared to not care about that. He did not appear to care that we were going to publish this case out to the public and give this case a little bit more of a highlight. So even today, almost 3 years later, well, actually a little over 3 years later, I'm still not happy about that decision because I feel like that request could have answered a lot of questions that you and I have about this case. However, folks, I will tell you guys this. I did end up receiving insider information later. In fact, it was about several months ago. This person that came forward talked to me about the information that he received about this man's trip to Walmart in Reynoldsburg, Ohio. Now, I'm going to let you all in on something here. This detail that I'm going to share with you all is going to be a very interesting detail because it might have something to do with the case. I'm not going to tell you what that is just yet, but I want you guys to understand that this could be telltale, and this could have something to do with how this John Doe ended up at an abandoned gas station with a bullet in his head. So we're going to hold on to that information for a minute. And before we do reveal that, we're going to go ahead and replay a clip from the original airing of True Cold Case Files from November of 2019, introducing this case, talking to you all about how this body was found and what was done immediately after. I'm going to forewarn everybody, quality is not that good. You have to remember back then, we didn't have the fancy mics that we have now. We were relying on, well, I guess you can say primitive technology. And hey, we all have to start somewhere, right? So I'm going to play that clip here in just a minute. But before I do, I want to remind everybody, go sign up for an account at crimewatchers.net. That's www.crimewatchers.net. Crime Watchers is a crime forum board that's in pursuit of the missing, the unidentified, and justice. Every case that we cover on From the Vault, including the Henry County John Doe, can be found at Crime Watchers. So go ahead, join in on the discussion, sign up for a free account. And if there's a case on there that you want, but you can't find, go ahead and start a new thread and talk about that case. You can sign up for a free account and start a new section dedicated to the subject you want to talk about. Go ahead, check it out, www.crimewatchers.net. So right now, I'm going to go ahead and play to you all an introduction on the case regarding this John Doe. And it starts in Knightstown, Indiana on October 2nd, 2003.
Jerry Kaysen and Frank Hittle, veterans of the Indianapolis Police Force, are touring an inmate who was residing in the Indianapolis jail at the time. The inmate had to have had some kind of pertinent information regarding some kind of a crime that had happened in Indianapolis. But, you know, with all kinds of crime fighting, you have to take a break at some point. So they decided to pull into this abandoned gas station, and they parked the car out front. And here's where the story gets interesting. Someone, one of them, I don't know exactly which one, because it was never identified who went to the rear of this gas station, and they noticed a dead body laying in this shrub of weeds in the back of the gas station. And these detectives, they contact the Henry County Sheriff's Office to take care of the situation, because you got to remember,
These are indie cops. They have no jurisdiction in Henry County. None at all.
Right.
So they had to hand it over to the proper authorities.
Well, the thing, okay, I have a quick question before we move further, just to like keep it in this area before we move further. So we're sure that the cops were stopping off with the inmate who's basically at this point being an informant, right? Or at least giving information about things he did and, you know, crimes he had committed.
That's what it sounds like,
So they were, who asked to stop off? It was the,
I believe it was the
detectives or the inmate?
I believe it was the inmate because based on some of the articles that I've read, it varies, but I think the most, the story I can identify with the most is the fact that the inmate had asked to use the restroom, and so they pulled into this abandoned gas station, and they went to relieve themselves, and someone found this dead body.
One thing that I don't understand based on this clip is that in hindsight, and knowing what I know about the area now, based on having been in that area since this recording, I'm a truck driver, by the way, is why did they not go into a gas station to use the restroom? Was it because the detectives had an inmate and he wasn't allowed in the store? Why did they choose this gas station, which ultimately led to them discovering a dead body that had been shot in the head? These are a couple of things that I had wondered. Because now, especially based on some of the information I received from some verified sources, as well as a personal visit I took into Knightstown on a quick trip, that area now is well developed. But in 2003, there was maybe one or two gas stations still in operation at this area. The building where this John Doe was found was abandoned, and it had been choked by weeds, which I'm assuming played into the advantage of being able to conceal this body. Whoever decided to conceal this body thought, well, this is an abandoned station. I don't think anyone's going to pull into here anytime soon. I don't think anyone's going to even notice a dead body here. Well, obviously they were wrong. The Henry County Sheriff's Office, led by Sheriff later turned County Commissioner Kim Kronk, took control of this investigation and had an autopsy performed on the John Doe, which determined his death. And also, the medical examiner was able to perform a physical on this John Doe to see where we're at, you know, regarding stats like weight, height, age, confirmation of what killed him. And according to the unidentified wiki webpage that our very own Nick Wagler operates, the Doe was described as follows. He was described as a Hispanic male, although an earlier newspaper did report him as a black male, which was not true, between the ages of 17 and 30 and about 5 feet 2, and he only weighed roughly 108 pounds. So this man was fairly short in stature and probably a lot smaller than most men. So this young man would have stood out somewhere, especially if you knew of a short Hispanic male who did disappear and you hadn't seen him since. This is a great bit of information to know. Another interesting feature that I had saw on his profile was that his jaw had been wired shut, and his teeth actually showed evidence of old brace brackets from previous dental work. Now, this actually stands out to me because obviously this young man had a dentist, and also it was interesting to note because of this work, he had braces possibly. And there was some areas and some reports that I saw that it looked like he had maybe removed them by force, which would probably have been a painful procedure. I wouldn't recommend that at all. But yeah, this was a very interesting situation here, was that his jaw had been wired shut and his teeth showed evidence of these old brace brackets, which also lead me to believe that it was a possibility this man broke his jaw. Either in a fight or maybe an injury. I'm not necessarily sure how, but it goes to show that this man probably was dealing with some issues here, especially if the reason his jaw was wired shut was because of a fight. So already red flags are being thrown here. Another physical feature noted was that he also had a small mole on his upper right shoulder that was measured about 3/4 of an inch. And he also had one on his lower back about the same size as well. And the clothing that he was wearing is described as follows. He wore a blue Malone USA shirt, brown work pants with a pair of Yukon sweatpants covering the pants, a pair of Reebok sneakers, white socks, and a Duke University ball cap. Now, I'm going to explain something here. Daisy and I discussed the fact that this young man may have possibly been in some kind of gang. Because if you remember, some gang members, well, or some gang organizations will use logos, existing logos from sports teams, universities, businesses, so on and so forth, that reflects the name of the affiliation. Like, for instance, in Fresno, there is a gang called the Bulldogs. They use the logo of the Fresno State University Bulldogs, that logo. And so that's basically like their mascot, if you will. So they probably go to a Walmart or a sports store. They'll buy the clothing and then they'll use it to show that they belong to this gang. So we kind of threw that idea around. But one thing that was very interesting was that this young man did not have tattoos. Even though that does not necessarily rule him out as being a gang member, there's a possibility that there's a reason for him not having tattoos if he was part of a gang. But I'm not very knowledgeable about that. I'm not going to pretend I am. So I'm going to leave that to the gang professionals, people who actually study these types of people and the crimes. So I'll leave that there. Now, one thing that I wanted to discuss too is that if you go to his Namus account, you can easily search it on Namus. There are actually photos of his body in the morgue. And one thing that I did notice was that the Malone USA t-shirt is not on him. It's actually an Abercrombie & Fitch t-shirt that he's wearing in the photo. Now, there could be a reason for this. Possibly, this shirt that this young man is wearing is likely a shirt that the funeral home put him in, while the Henry County Sheriff's Office likely kept his original clothing for evidentiary purposes. So, for instance, they may be trying to do a pollen test on the shirt or any part of the clothing and stuff like that. They want to make sure that they're not tampering with the evidence, and they'll likely want to revert back to the clothing later on, especially if they're going to do further testing on it. So this is likely the reason why he was put in this shirt. But then there could be other reasons, like the Malone USA shirt was probably too messy for him to wear, and they weren't going to tamper with the evidence because, well, it's evidence. And they weren't going to machine wash the shirt because of the blood on it. And like I said, it's evidence. So plainly speaking, Henry County likely kept the original clothing as evidence, and they just dressed this man in something nice that he could be buried in. So anyways, ladies and gentlemen, this is the part where we're going to get into some interesting territory here on this case. Later on, this young man was apparently seen at a Walmart, according to investigators with the Henry County Sheriff's Office. He had been seen alive at a Walmart in Reynoldsburg, Ohio, on September 30th of 2003. It was also revealed that he had been driving a red car in the area as well. Now, the details until this point have been scarce about how they were able to connect him to this Walmart. Again, remember the questions that I asked. Why was he at the Walmart? What did he purchase? How was he seen? Is there proof that he was there, like a picture or receipt? Anything. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in this episode, I am happy to discuss this part of the investigation based on some inside information that I did receive from a verified person, a verified informant, if you will. But I was able to get a little bit of information, and I think that this information might go a long way to possibly helping identify this young man. Now, what has been left out of the public information on this case is that a store receipt had actually been found on this man's body. It was a Walmart receipt that was traced to the store in Reynoldsburg, Ohio. Now, I will say this, the details of the receipt were telling. That night, the John Doe had actually paid in cash, ready for this? A pregnancy test. The revealing purchase actually has me asking new questions. Why did John Doe purchase a pregnancy test? Does this pregnancy test have something to do with his murder? Perhaps he impregnated a woman and the woman's significant other found out. Like, this should be something the Henry County Sheriff's Office should be willing to discuss with the public openly, as this is a possibility that it could be a very important piece of this complicated puzzle surrounding this man's murder. I mean, the possibilities are endless when you consider a purchase like this. Like, was there something that could be in a way foreshadowing this man's eventual murder. I mean, after I was told about this, I was floored. I was like, well, this could possibly explain one of the reasons why he was murdered. He ended up getting someone pregnant, and this woman's, I don't know, significant other may have found out and killed the man. And panicked, he probably tried to figure out a way to dump the body, and, well, he went as rural as he could get. And he went all the way to Henry County, Indiana, committing a federal crime in the process. As again, if you kill somebody in one state and you cross state lines and dump them in another one, that becomes a federal offense. The FBI get involved at that point. Now, the question still remains, did the FBI get involved in this case when it happened? Did they? I've always been wondering that. But again, my FOIA request was rejected in 2018 by Captain Manning for unknown reasons. I mean, like I said, I still don't buy the whole everything's out in the public already excuse. Because again, there are so many questions that need to be answered about the Walmart visit and other things. It bugs me here. I will admit to that. It bugs me. But as I said, I believe this receipt should have been discussed with the public a long time ago, especially to people who investigators may have reached out to in Ohio if they did a push to try to identify this man, if they put posters up in the area in Reynoldsburg trying to identify this man. I mean, there's some possibilities. I hope that they did try some efforts like flyers or a news broadcast out that way, because that could have been very, very helpful. And then here we are with the car theory, the red car that this John Doe is supposedly driving. Where is it? Whose car was it? Is there a photographic still out there that could be fixed? And we might be able to retrieve a license plate number from it. I mean, there's a lot of things that could play out here. And I think, honestly, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, my humble opinion only, that if this pregnancy test can reveal the killer, then we need to start trying to push more for this young man's identification. And I hope that's being done through forensic genealogy. And I hope that the Henry County Sheriff's Office has reached out to a geneticist so that way this can be done. But with that being said, I mean, like I said, this was a shocking piece of the puzzle that I was recently privy to. And yeah, I mean, things begin to not add up once again in this case. Because originally, I thought that this could have been a possible inside job. I'm not going to lie to you. Some of the events surrounding this case did not add up. Like, how did two cops and an inmate suddenly find a dead body out in the middle of nowhere? I asked myself this, but then as the years progress, I tend to kind of exonerate them. But again, no one is innocent until, you know, proven otherwise. So everyone's still a suspect in my book, even the detectives, even though they've been ruled out. But like I said, there needs to be some other proof. And I'm sure there might be proof. There might be an alibi somewhere. Again, the records would have helped. So there's that. But I will mention here that it was believed that the man was murdered elsewhere and not at the scene. There was no bullet casing or blood splatter to indicate that he was killed at this location. And as I just mentioned here, I originally thought the detectives could have had something to do with it. And a later event would actually kind of influence my thought, but I think it was just an isolated event we'll get into here in just a minute. But the detectives that were mentioned in this case, Frank Hittell and Jerry Kaysen, they turned in their service weapons so that they could be checked for any signs that they were used recently. And then the results did come back negative, so they were cleared on this case. They were cleared in the murder because also, too, they probably compared the bullet with the bullet that was found in this John Doe's head and then also a couple of other factors. So going back to Frank Hittell for a minute, he was a detective over there at the Indianapolis Police Department. I kind of want to talk about him for a second because he ended up having some legal issues. And if I'm not mistaken, he also had been suspended from the Indianapolis Police at one point in the late 90s. But we're going to an event on October 4th of 2003. That is literally 2 days after this John Doe's body was found. Frank Hittell would be suspended from the Indianapolis Police Department after he got into an altercation at Brad's Brass Flamingo, a nightclub in Indianapolis, with a paraplegic man named Michael Farmer. He would plead guilty on July 15th of 2004 to charges of disorderly conduct. Originally, he was facing some pretty serious charges, but they were able to drop it down to disorderly conduct, which is a misdemeanor. He would be suspended from the Indianapolis Police Department for 90 days, and he was fined $250. He was also sentenced to 180 days in jail, which was suspended. Meanwhile, Farmer sustained injuries, including a black eye and a missing tooth. And a report from the Indianapolis Star stated that Farmer was facing over $2,500 in medical bills from the altercation, and that he was actually mulling a civil suit against Hittell so that way he could pay for the medical bills. The end result of that, I was never able to find out. So hopefully he was able to get that all settled, and I'm hoping that he's doing all right. So let's hope, you know, he's doing all right out there. So, yeah. So with that being said, you know, maybe that altercation that happened at the Brass Flamingo proved that after the Henry County incident, maybe he was feeling stress from the event. And cops do go through that. They do go through a period where maybe, you know, they get stressed from a scene, like a suicide that was pretty nasty, or a very graphic homicide, especially homicides involving children. That does tend to affect the psyche of law enforcement officers. Doesn't matter how long they've been on the force for, murders like that hit the heart a little different. And, you know, even though he was exonerated from this investigation, I mean, did it actually hit harder than, you know, than it maybe should have, considering his profession? There's possibilities surrounding that. And the only person who would have that answer is Detective Hittell. And maybe he'd be willing to share that with me on another episode of From the Vault. I'd be more than happy to hear him out about the incident and, you know, his thoughts about that day in Henry County. Meanwhile, after the autopsy, the John Doe's body was returned to Knightstown. There, the community did raise funds for his funeral, and he was buried in a Christian tradition by a local pastor. According to an email that was exchanged between a friend of the podcast, also named Jason, and the Reverend had recalled the day as a day of sadness, and that he remembered people coming together to make sure that this young man was buried. And this John Doe was buried at the Louisville Cemetery near Knightstown. His grave stands alone in a section of the cemetery with a small stone and a figure of St. Anthony. And according to research, St. Anthony is the patron saint of small requests, as well as the patron saint of the finder of lost things. As individuals, we can feel the presence of St. Anthony. If anything, we do have a small request to identify this man. And to those at the Henry County Sheriff's Office, perhaps this saint can be the guide for them to find the lost thing. And to this day, he's still a John Doe. DNA does exist in his case. And I'm certain that it might be utilized in the future for comparison on a forensic genealogy database by a geneticist. Hope, because I think that's going to be the key to getting him identified, is doing the forensic genealogy program. And recently I spoke with Anthony Redgrave over at Redgrave Research. He's helping me build my family tree. And we were talking about, you know, Hispanics being underrepresented in these databases as well as African Americans. And it makes the process a little bit difficult in trying to identify someone who might be an underrepresented minority in these databases, which I can believe it. I mean, I just recently did my ancestry DNA test, and a lot of my dad's side of the family is very underrepresented in the result. And I was highly represented on my mom's side. She is a Caucasian woman. So there was a lot of relatives I was able to identify. But on my dad's side, it was pretty scarce. So I understand that now. I understand what, you know, DNA Doe Project was talking about with the Apache Junction Jane Doe, where there was very big underrepresentations on her family tree. So I get it. And I hope, though, at least this would be an opportunity for this John Doe to get his name back. I hope that perhaps his family has utilized this database and that the law enforcement officials could possibly link this young man to a close relative, and a close relative could possibly identify him. And I hope so, because this is, like I said before, this is one of these cases that I've always thought about and I hope can get some kind of resolution here in the future. With that said, this case will be one of those cases. Again, I just mentioned this a second ago, but this will be one of those cases that I will forever remember. And I can only hope that it will soon come to a conclusion. Now, if you or anyone you know knows anything about this case, do you remember a suspicious car being parked at this abandoned gas station on Highway 103 in Knightstown, Indiana, by Interstate 70 on October 2nd of 2003? Do you recall a young man who was seen at a Walmart driving a red car just days before in Reynoldsburg, Ohio? Does anyone know anything about this case? If you do, you are urged to contact the Henry County Sheriff's Office. That phone number is 765-529-5669. Again, that phone number is 765-529-5669. And the agency case number is 03-020257. Case number again is 03-020257. You can also contact the Henry County Coroner's Office, and the contact person is Stacy Guffey. You can reach Stacy at 765-545-0301. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, the next episode, Nick and I are going to be talking about Larry Eiler's unidentified victims. He's got a few unidentified victims still out there, and Nick and I will talk about those cases a little bit in depth. And we'll briefly touch up on Eiler's case, on his case as a synopsis. Like I said earlier in the show, we don't glorify serial killers here. So we're going to give you guys an opportunity to see some of his unresolved individuals that he murdered. So we're going to be talking about Adam Doe, specifically, a case in Jasper County, Indiana, and a case near Indianapolis involving a young man that was found on the side of a road. All of that and more on the next episode of From the Vault. And that will be our second to last episode, because after that will be our season finale. And we will be wrapping up our very first season of From the Vault. Again, I'd like to thank Zach Bebo for the editing job he does, the great work that he does on From the Vault. And also a special thanks to Anchor and Crime Watchers for sponsoring today's show. I'm Jason Futch, and thank you all for joining me on another episode of From the Vault. And I will see you on the next episode. Thanks again.